Hi, and welcome to the Filmmaker Toolkit Podcast. I'm Chris O'Fault, Executive Editor of Craft and Special Projects at IndieWire. And my guest today is director Ethan Hawke. Yes, that's right, director, not actor, because we are talking about his new film, Wildcat, a biopic of sorts about a young Flannery O'Connor starring his daughter Maya, which will be released by our friends at Oscilloscope this Friday on May 3rd. Ethan, while he's on the podcast, talked about making the film with his daughter, wrestling with O'Connor's history with race, what he learned from all the great directors he's worked with, and why the theme of creativity and what it means to be an artist seems to be such a driving force behind his own work as an artist at this stage in his career. Ethan's a treat to talk to, and I hope you enjoy this conversation. Tell me a little bit about the origin of this project. I understand it has something to do with possibly a Juilliard audition.
Yeah, I guess that would be, you know, what is the origin myth, right? Maya was working on her drama school auditions, and, you know, one of the perceived benefits and possible total annoyances of going into the same profession that your father does is that, of course, they're going to have some opinions about what a drama school audition. I mean, I did that. Right.
So she was even what they pick, right? Even what they pick to
read. Well, that's what I'm talking about. What she picks, you know, and she's thinking, well, maybe I'll do the Come Romeo speech from Romeo and Juliet. I'm like, listen, I promise they just heard that 10,000 times. And I was annoying her about it. And then she came up with this idea that she wanted to make a monologue out of Flannery O'Connor's prayer journal, which is really kind of a brilliant idea, particularly in an audition setting. Because the monologue was about the positive and negative manifestations of ambition, about why a person would want to be a successful artist. And is it in service of your own self-aggrandizement, or is it in the service of something larger than that? And if it was, what would that be? And am I lying by saying I wanted to be a part of something greater when all I really want to be is fabulous myself? And Flannery is very insightful about that. And Maya took several journal entries and sculpted them into a speech. And she did it in the kitchen right upstairs here. And it was incredible. I mean, I knew she'd get in. It's like, okay, that's incredible. And I think after her time at Juilliard, she had already loved Flannery O'Connor's writing as an example of just a ferocious female intellect that isn't oriented around boys and dresses. And, you know, Flannery is kind of the opposite of Louisa May Alcott or Emily Dickinson or what we think of as the beautiful female writer. You know, she was kind of I always say Flannery O'Connor is the writer Charles Bukowski was pretending to be. And so anyway, she got really interested in this character of Flannery O'Connor. Like, she's not even thinking necessarily about the person, the human being, but it was a characterization that she liked. There's something ferocious about this young, fragile, delicate woman with this wild animal of a brain. You know, this woman in crutches who's writing about sin. And
Prayer Journal is her wrestling with a lot of this stuff, right?
Yeah,
It's not like one of her better known pieces of fiction. It's more of her essay as a writer, right?
It's really just a journal of a very brilliant young woman. I mean, I think she's 19 to 22. I could be wrong about that, but it's in that area of her life. It's definitely before she was ever published. And it's what you really see in this Prayer Journal is her relationship to her prayer life. And it's so earnest that it's striking. So anyway, when Stranger Things started to blow up and Maya felt that she had some, you know, for lack of a better word, power, or like people were interested in what she was going to do next, she was like, I want to make a movie about Flannery O'Connor. She went and got the rights. She met this guy, Joe Goodman, who had had the rights to a lot of her stories and the Prayer Journal. And then she came to my wife and I saying, hey, you guys, would you ever want to produce and direct? Would you ever want to make this movie? First off, there's something so remarkable about when your adult child wants to work with you. It feels like a victory somehow that they can choose to not be with you and they're choosing to be with you. And there's also the combination that this subject matter was so difficult. It was such a, it's not a layup. You know, I mean, how do you make a movie about Flannery O'Connor? This is a woman who didn't do anything her whole life except feed the chickens and write. She's born and raised in the Jim Crow South. And there's so many obstacles of how to tell this story in a way that might be meaningful to people. But one of the things about her life that's meaningful to me is the integration of faith and human creativity. Like, she was an incredibly devout person, and she found a way to pour her spiritual seeking into her creative life without proselytizing, without having an agenda about what the reader is supposed to do or say next. It's just her expressing herself, which I was really moved by. And I thought, wow, if I could make a movie about the intersection between creativity, faith, and reality, and how those three things are integrated, well, that would be a very personal film for me. And I had made a biopic before. I hate biopics. I can't believe I've now made two of them. But I made this film called Blaze. I think a good biopic is not really about the subject matter. It's making meaningful, substantive art, using the subject matter as a launching point for a conversation. And Blaze Foley is a wonderful conversation point about what is success, what is failure, what are the wells of human creativity. You know, like there's in our movie, the Townes Van Zandt kind of represents that part of the artist that wants to set themselves on fire. And then his relationship with Sybil Rosen is this other well of human creativity, falling in love, living in a treehouse, feeding squirrels, dancing naked by moonlight, you know, these healthy manifestations. And so I saw in Flannery, I was like, oh, wow, this is a subject I would really like to talk about, which is how can my development as an artist be integrated to my development as a human being? And so I said yes to Maya. I was like, all right, let's try to do this. I don't think I'd ever believed we'd actually get the movie made. You know, you never know what's going to happen and what's not going to happen in this life.
Maybe it's just what the algorithm feeds us, but I feel like I can't go on Instagram now without some inspiring quote from you talking about creativity and thinking about the role that art plays in your life and our life. And it does feel like in the films that you have made and that you have produced, this is almost becoming a subject of interest for you, of the role that creativity, in particular, when it becomes public, is.
I would have never predicted this. I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about, and I don't know.
You didn't go into this thinking this is going to be my theme.
I don't have any agenda or some theme, but I think because I started so young, and because I've worked really hard to stay alive and stay curious and not, you know, there's a certain amount of jadedness or bitterness that whenever you take something that has a possibility of being beatific, like self-expression, and you pimp it, you pay, you know, I pay for my doctor bills and my kids' school and food on our table with it. I mean, this is how I make a living, right? You can get super jaded about it, and it can lose the fire that lit it in the first place. And I've watched that happen so much that I've ended up spending a lot of time working on, like, well, why do I still want to do this? My joke to people is like, I literally started acting the same time I had a paper route. Like, what if I was still doing my paper route? I mean, I would think I'd be disillusioned with the value of delivering papers. So maintaining a relationship to the profession that is changing and evolving. And so, like, I have to have a relationship as a person in their 50s to acting now, which was different than when I was 22. And I think it's taken me here. And so I've now been interviewed for 20 years talking about this kind of bullshit. And so I have to continue to speak to it. And funnily enough, life has presented me, like, I was thinking about this the other day. I was like, wow, I could do a little film festival on movies about arts. Like, I did this movie Maudie with Sally Hawkins about a brilliant painter. I did the Chet Baker movie. I did Blaze. I did Seymour, the documentary about a piano maestro. I did The Last Movie Stars about two great actors. Now I'm doing this movie about a famous writer. I'm like, wow, I did not foresee a theme here, but one is presenting itself to me of, like, I see where my brain gravitates to. I mean, obviously, I do other things.
No. One of the things that you are, in addition to the religion issue, and maybe it's tied to this, is there seems to be an open question here. The role suffering plays in creation. Obviously, Flannery O'Connor has, for people that don't know, this film takes place right up to this moment where she starts writing all of her sitting down and writing all of her great work. And at the same time, she's discovered she's suffering from lupus and has gone back home and is definitely
suffering.
And it's
not like lupus is now where there's medicine and things. It was a death sentence. You know, her father had died of lupus and died pretty quickly. So when she was diagnosed, you know, at 24, she lived to 39, but I don't think there's a year that she was sure she would see the next Christmas. And so when you're living, she called them diminishments, you know, every year she was diminished, losing the power to walk, comfort, traveling, even her ability to write was compromised. And so she wasn't a social person. There was a lot that was lost. And she started realizing how much was gained every time she lost something. And I think that I know people like Richard Linklater, for example. One of the reasons why I love him so much is he's a great artist. And I dare you to meet that guy and see him in a bad mood. It just doesn't happen. I mean, the guy works from a place of joy. So it's very possible.
Yeah.
You know, it's very possible. But I think you have to be very compassionate, very empathetic, and very well read to push yourself to a depth of thinking that mortality forces. Yeah. You know, I mean, Flannery was shoved in the deep end of the pool. She wasn't allowed to think about pretty dresses and getting married and, I don't know, going to parties or whether or not she wanted to join the communist revolution or anything like that because she was sick in her room. Right. And a lot of her friends were doing all these fabulous things in that period. And so I think it elevated her thought. And I do think that you don't get something for nothing in this life. Right. I mean, whether we're talking about Kafka or a lot of our great writers, they're kind of forced into thinking in a less superficial way than most of us do.
You were talking before about this, you know, how does one enter a biopic? And this is not a traditional biopic by any means. And maybe what you just said is self-evident, the self-evident answer to this, but it feels like you and your writing partner quickly focused in on this early 20s period that leads right to her great writing, right?
Absolutely. Like this, the essential idea that Shelby Gaines is my partner. And we just spent months meditating, reading Flannery's work and trying to go like, okay, what would the movie here be? And a very obvious answer came, well, Maya's 24. And at 24, we weren't just writing a Flannery O'Connor, but we were writing it for Maya. Right. And so
that helps to a certain degree.
Oh, right? It helps a lot because, I mean, I think if Maya had been 35, I probably would have done the end of her life. Right. You know, but it's like, well, Maya wants to play this part at 24 years old is when she got the diagnosis. I'm like, all right, let's make a movie about that month. And then Shelby made this discovery that I found really powerful that in her room, she'd turned her typewriter away from the window. You know, she couldn't go up the stairs or anything. So she had to sit in on the ground floor, and she had her typewriter set against the dresser and made kind of a little shrine. And Shelby had this thought of like, well, this is amazing. She's not allowed to travel anymore. And now she doesn't even want to look out the window. We started thinking about it. One of her favorite lines is the kingdom of God is in the midst of you. We started really thinking about that line that you ultimately don't need to go anywhere. We all already have everything we need. You know, you hear this about the Tibetan monks in Chinese prisons. You know, they get their fingernails pulled out and had a great day, you know, because of their inner life is so rich and what they're thinking about and what they're praying about and what they're... And I think that Flannery realized she couldn't go anywhere. She brought the world to her. And I was like, well, what if the whole movie is about that realization? Just like, how do you arrive at that place of acceptance and seeing diminishments as a positive?
Because going home, and one of the things that I found so powerful about this is we start in New York, and not that life is easy for her in New York, but she's surrounded by at least a couple people of like mind.
Yeah.
And a world with at least a few people that recognize her skill. And the return home to a small-minded, and I think that's the
criteria. Oh, she's very clear about this in her journals. It's the last place she wants to go is Milledgeville, Georgia.
And then for that small visit to turn into essentially where she would spend the rest of her life, it feels like that would be devastating. And I think what's so, and it is for a while, and that's why the spoiler, the ending is so powerful, is this acceptance, is a move towards that.
There's a scene with Liam Neeson. I thought it would be almost revolutionary or at least interesting to show a positive relationship to the clergy today. You just don't see it in movies.
And you need it because the mom is so small-minded in terms of the religious view in the town.
And he comes in there, this guy just thinking, oh, here's just some other young kid. I'll, you know, give her some pamphlets and get out of here. And they end up having a really serious conversation about the theme of the movie, basically, joy is sorrow overcome. Once you really accept the reality of your situation and then can greet it with love, right? Then things start to open up, at least for you, inside yourself. And that's the pivot that the movie makes that brings on, I think, the final beat of the film.
Let's talk about the choice to enter some of O'Connor's stories here. the idea that Flannery O'Connor might be hard to adapt is been well established, but there's something there about the way you approach this and entering it through snippets, but also in the double acting of Maya and Laura Linney. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the decision there of entering some of those stories and then how you...
Well, part of me was like, wow, if you're thinking about the life of a writer, if you don't know their writing, you don't know them, right? That's where like your inner self is most revealed. That thing Shelby and I would talk about is like, if I told you what I did this morning, I woke up at this time, I ate this, I called this person, I gave you all the facts of my life, you would know very little about me. If I really shared with you everything that I was dreaming of, everything that I was afraid of, everything I was hoping for, like if I told you my secret dreams, right, we would be intimate, because this movie basically ends before she's ever, you know, had anything really published. All her great work lies ahead of her. And we're working in this idea of exploring different aspects of Miss O'Connor through her writing. As I read her canon, you start to see, oh, I recognize this. I see that, oh, you start to see her mother in this story. You see her mother in that story. You see, you know, they, sometimes they're blonde, sometimes they're brunette, sometimes they're this, sometimes they're rich.
They have a wood leg.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was basically saying to Maya and Laura Linney, who plays her mother, it's not exactly you're playing different characters. You're entering Flannery's imagination, and you are a different aspect of the mother. And we are exploring Flannery's relationship with her mother through these dreams. And then that gets you into the whole nature of imagination does impact reality. Everything in our life was first thought of, whether it's this table, this microphone, everything started in somebody's head. And so imagination is reality in the long arc of time, right? And so these are real. People used to say to me, how are people going to know what's real and what's not real? I'm like, well, the thesis statement of the movie is that imagination is real. So if I can't blow that equation by making it too literal, that her imaginative life is real. This is her relationship with her mother. It's just, they just have different outfits on. And because she can't go anywhere, she's going through time and space in her brain. And it works for me.
It's one thing I feel like a lot of independent films should do more of is looking for these opportunities also to create wonderful, juicy roles for great actors to come in and do for a day or two, you know, because
we had that in Space.
You did. Cause it's like Steven Zahn could come in and do the
so
Traveler.
Amazing. I know.
Cooper Hoffman. That is unreal.
He and Maya are so good. Rafael Casal, Liam Neeson, we have all these wonderful people who, Philip Ettinger, you know, and all of whom I know from some capacity, or Maya knows from some place in our life. And so I was able to build on a pre-existing relationship and invite these. What was great about all these actors coming in is they're the lead of their own movie. Cooper Hoffman, he worked 4 days or something like that, but every day.
And that one's almost a whole arc. That's like a whole story.
It's a whole story. And it's a real character. And so he's the lead of his movie. And, you know, Steve Zahn's the lead of his movie. And I think Maya would say, if she was here, the immense electric jolt they give the set. It was almost always the first or last day of filming. It's like, oh, it's Cooper's first day. It's Cooper's last day. Oh, Steve Zahn's here. You know, you're driving to set and you're nervous because Steve's coming. And what's it going to be like? And how's it going to... Because every actor impacts the set dramatically. It's just the way it moves. And they're like a living animal. So yeah, I'm proud of that. I'm proud of all those people's work.
The story with Cooper, of the traveling Bible salesman, is a perfect short film in and of itself. I almost wonder if you cut it out, maybe you might need to film a little bit more. I'm wondering if you could talk about that story in specific, because that's one where to let that play out from beginning to end and how it folds into.
That's the only one that we really show in full, pretty much. You know, it's the most explored. It's the last one.
What is that story, Ethan?
It's called Good Country People. And the reason why we did that is that's the first and perhaps only true auto fiction she does. You know, and I found in letters how much, you know, it's a character named named Joy, who changes her name to Holga. And, you know, Flannery was on crutches. She's got a character with a wooden leg, similar relationship with her mother. She wants to be a writer. She thinks she's smarter than everybody. And in first glance, yeah, the traveling salesman's kind of a crook. But so is she. She's trying to play him. She just gets outplayed. You know, she thinks she's so much smarter than him. And I kind of started to see that story as a confession of sorts, as Flannery's, you know, it comes off the scene with Liam where he says, you know, it's time for a proper confession. And we go into this story. In this story, I kind of saw as her confession is sometimes I don't believe in God. Sometimes I'm scared that I have no faith. I'm arrogant. I'm vain. I'm judgmental. And I'm really hurt by those things. And so I felt like that's also the first time where we explore the fictional universe in the real space. Like it's actually filmed in the same sets as her actual house. And so it all looks the same. I love it. It turns my brain on. But I think that's the power of that story is, and the power of confession, right? Is if you take accountability of your weaknesses, you can start to grow. And when you're in denial of them, then they're atrophying, you know, they're getting worse. And so I love that story. And that Cooper was great. I have to say, I saw somebody Twitter some, or, you know, I know it's not called Twitter anymore, but whatever, that they said, they're talking about, imagine this rich guy running for office who's selling Bibles to pay off his legal fee for for his affair with a porn star. They're like, this sounds like a Flannery O'Connor short story. And I was like, yes, you get it. She was up to tricks.
You know, I wasn't going to bring this up, but I was reading the press notes, and it seems like something that you were obviously struggling with, talking about dealing with warts and all. In the process of developing this story, there's been a lot of reconsiderations about Flannery O'Connor and race. And I guess one particular article, I think, in The New Yorker kind of set you into your own, you and Maya's own kind of reconciling of like how to handle these things.
It's really tough, you know, because you're faced with a dilemma, which is, if you talk about the history of America honestly, you're going to talk about America's crimes and America's wounds and a lot of painful things. People don't, if they want to talk about racism, they generally like to do it in the framework of like, this racist is really bad. You know, like, they have horns in their head, they're doing terrible things. Whereas the real history of systemic racism is a lot of alleged nice people going along with the ride that's very hurtful to other people and taking advantage of their privileged position, right? And Flannery grew up, was fed, raised on the water of the Jim Crow South. When I was first given her writing, I was given her writing by my mother, who my mother was trying to champion female writers. I mean, I was given to her as like my mom trying to say, be a feminist, right?
Let's rethink the canon here.
Just read Faulkner, for crying out loud. And I had read this Alice Walker interview about Flannery O'Connor that said, you know, there isn't a hint of Magnolia in the air in any of Flannery O'Connor's short stories. And I had seen her, you know, if you read Everything Rises Must Converge, which is really staring, which is the, we do pieces of that, of the scene in the bus with Maya and Laura, and, you know, this patronizing white woman wants to give this African-American boy a penny, you know, she gets her ass kicked. I mean, Flannery is so funny. Flannery does not virtue signal. She is allergic to virtue signaling. Or there's revelations in which Jesus Christ of Nazareth spouts racist slurs, right? This is radical writing. It was radical in the 50s. It's radical now. There'll be people that hate this movie because... but I really viewed it as like, to take that, the scene with Jesus, for example, is it's just a brilliant way to see white supremacy is dressed up in the clothes of Jesus. I mean, that's how buried it is in the consciousness of these women and men, and how obsessed with status we as human beings are. And so much of her writing, it's a line another scholar said that I loved, is that she is racist. And she's trying to recover, like America. She's a recovering racist. And some days she's doing really well. And some days history does not look favorably upon her. But Alice Walker has this line, like, be careful if you throw away your geniuses. You know, and I think Maya and I were put in this position. I didn't know any of the darker elements of some people finding letters and some really ugly things. I didn't know any of that until we were deep in this project. And I said to Maya, I was like, well, do we quit? How afraid of this conversation are we? And we ended up walking away with, well, I think whenever you're talking about, as long as we're not selling that she's Saint Flannery, she's just a young woman trying to be an artist growing up in America. That's what it's like. And to be honest, she looks at it, at least she sees it. You know, Margaret Mitchell and these other people, they don't even see it. You know, she sees white hypocrisy and she doesn't try to write about anything she doesn't understand. The people she's writing about are people she knows. And she sees them, you know, all the racists in her stories get gored by bulls. And
she's radically honest with herself about everything.
And that's her, one of her favorite lines is, it's a quote from Matthew about, you know, take the smote out of your own eye before, like, hypocrisy, hypocrisy, hypocrisy. She hates it. She hates when people act like they're on the moral high ground. Mystery is what she was all about. Like, we're all people who mean well, for crying aloud. We all say we mean well and we do terrible things. So let's stop talking about who means well. Like, let's talk about the mystery of, we're on a star in space. We don't know why we're born. We don't know why we have to die. We don't know and understand nature. We don't understand the world that we're living in. We don't understand each other. And here's some examples, you know, and that's what her short stories are full of. So I decided that I wasn't scared of this conversation and that if she makes people angry, they have a right to be angry. And let's talk about that, because it doesn't do us any good to just ignore it.
You were talking before about there being some concern about going into the short stories and with the same actors, and in some cases, in the case of the Cooper Hoffman one, the same location. I'm very curious about your choices with your cinematographer, Steve Cozens, who you've worked with a few times now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he did Blaze and the Chet Baker movie, Born to be Blue.
There's an element here of these beautiful frames, these widescreen kind of anamorphic frames, and just trying to capture as much in one frame as possible. And it's a very unique window onto this. I'm wondering how, and I think this applies, I mean, please you tell me, I've only gotten to see the film once, but the approach to certain, it carries over into both the stories and to the present day.
It's a form meets content thing where Miss O'Connor's writing is so disciplined. I mean, that's the genius of a great short story when it works, is they pack the same punch that a novel does sometimes in 8 pages, 12 pages, 17 pages. If you read A Good Man Is Hard to Find, it has kind of what I think is one of the great endings of all time, which is that woman would be all right if she had somebody to shoot her every day of her life, you know? And something, I'm paraphrasing, but she wrote it better than that. But it stays, you read A Good Man Is Hard to Find, it stays with you forever. And it's 70 something years old and it's still fresh and radical. It's so disciplined. For example, when Steve Cozens and I were shooting Blaze, Blaze is sloppy, Blaze is messy, Blaze moves through life recklessly. We kind of had this decision on that movie, you know what? We're gonna need one lens. We're gonna be handheld, we're gonna move around, we're gonna improvise scenes, we're gonna be Blaze-esque. In the filmmaking, it should feel like the film is duct taped together. It should feel cheap. It should feel, you should smell the bar. You know, the music shouldn't sound too good. He never got to play with, you know, precise instruments and good recording and, you know, da da da. And now with Flannery, we have a different challenge. This woman's art is meticulous. And we started seeing this of like, well, how much information could we pack into each frame? How little could we be cutting? How could we achieve, for lack of a better word, an elegance? You know, I think what's so striking about her is it's elegant and it almost feels folk artish. It's both disciplined and childlike in ways that I just love. And so the actor in me loves body language. I love seeing actors relate to each other. I love a two shot. I love seeing the dynamics. I hate being manipulated. I hate, you know, and I learned this really hardcore with Paul Schrader about inviting the audience into a dialogue with you. If you keep doing a close up on the tear and the eye and the violins play and, you know, and then you do these quick cuts and you're telling them exactly, this is where the energy is. This is how you're supposed to feel now. This is how you're supposed to feel now. As opposed to inviting them in for a conversation where you can look where you want to look. We're going to move almost in a fever dreamish way. I just gravitated to it. And I thought, it was a very tricky thing because if I shot the real life stuff wildly different than I shot the imagination, I was saying something I didn't want to say. I don't think there was a difference. I think if you met Flannery on, you know, May 2nd, the year that she was alive, the event of her day was those couple paragraphs. She'd be talking to you and she'd be, you know, we'd be having tea or whatever, but she wasn't thinking about what she was saying to you. I've kind of felt like she had two primary relationships in her life, you know, one with Jesus and the other with her mother, you know, and
both were a struggle.
And they both were a struggle.
I'm curious, you've referenced a couple of the great directors you've worked with. Is it just natural that you're carrying over lessons that you learned from decades of being on set and working with directors? Is there things that you've been able to pull upon?
I mean, acting and directing are both interpretive arts. They're mm-hmm. very similar. I mean, directing requires managerial skills and some other things that you have to be a little bit of a huckster to get the money to make it. You know, there's a certain difference in the skill set. But so many of the directors I worked with, like, you know, take Sidney Lumet, for example. Sidney Lumet spent his life on Sidney Lumet sets. He just thought that's the way to make a movie, is the way that he makes a movie. But you would come on to do his movie and we rehearsed for 3 weeks. We did the whole movie in a warehouse with tape on the ground with the crew there watching. We did a performance of the movie and he thought that's the way you make a movie. I'd never done that, you know, in 25 years of filmmaking. I'd never done that. Richard Linklater has his way of doing it. Antoine Fuqua has his way of doing it. Corey Ada has his way. Pavel Pavlikowski has his way. All these people are brilliant, right? And you start, as an actor, you really internalize the fact that there is not a right way to do this. There are a lot of wrong ways. I mean, you also see a lot of
you've gotten some exposure to that as well.
Stupid shit people get up to that's just a waste of time and energy. But I think, you know, it doesn't surprise me when George Clooney starts directing and his first film is excellent because you're like, oh, this guy's been mentoring. It's not his first film. He's spent years on a film set, you know, and years at the left hand of great artists. He wasn't, you know, doing catering or something. I mean, he was right there with every shot being set up. If you're predisposed to be interested in directing, you're given a great education if you want to use it. And so I definitely, you know, Alfonso Cuarón, I'd never seen anybody so obsessed with the power of color. You know, and Almodovar is the same way. Really, really interested in what color achieves in the viewer. You know, Peter Weir was really interested in tone. What is the mood? And he used to play music for us. We were young when I did Dead Poets Society. And he would, you know, if you put on Exile on Main Street, the room behaves a certain way. If you put on Beethoven, the room behaves another way. We're all capable of so. So the idea of my character would or would not do that, Peter would say, what mood are they in?
I'm capable
of being moral and ethical and a person of dignity, and I'm capable of being a thief and a crook. What mood am I in? What am I reacting against? And, you know, I could go through all these different directors and say, like, sometimes it's overwhelming when I'm because I'm like, I'll be sitting up a shot.
Because like, what is Ethan Hawke interested in?
What do I think? Yeah, I'm thinking, well, Sidney Lumet would hate this shot. Antoine Fuqua would do this with a shot. This person would do. And also I have the actors I admire in my head. You do have to, at some point, kind of throw all that away and trust your inner compass and go, all right, I'm going to live and die on my own sword here. And funnily enough, I love the way that Lumet and Linklater are the two people I've worked with who really love to rehearse. It's really a part of what they need to, Almodovar too, they need it to excel. They need it to find their confidence, to see the movie, and to be on the same imaginative plane as all their collaborators. I would love to work that way. I didn't have the money.
It's a luxury that people
don't. Yeah, I didn't have the power or the money to do that. If I want to get, you know, these great actors to come in, I'm not paying any of them. I can't have them just spend 2 weeks rehearsing their four scenes. You know, it's not fair to them. And they're all so good. So I have to work another way. And one of the ways that I cheat that is by working with people that I know really well and trust really well. I know what Liam Neeson is capable of. I don't need
You have a shorthand. You have an understanding with them already.
Absolutely. I started a theater company with Steve Zahn when we were 21. So I know exactly. I can say to him, hey, dude, I'm going to sit in the back with the camera. You and Maya improvise and you drive this 52 Studebaker with one arm. Great. No problem. Cause I know he's got that, you know, he's got that. And we drove around through the farms and they just spun their wheels. It was amazing.
I think any father would relate to what you had said in the beginning of this interview about it's a dream to have a project to work on, you know, to have something with an adult child who that you could share something like this with. I certainly relate to it. I am curious though, when it came to directing, what was that like working? Because Maya's obviously a very talented actress. She's fantastic in this. But are you able to work with her in that same way that you are other people?
I make this joke, and Maya and I both make this joke, that every family has fault lines, like places where you step where it's dangerous. You know, you touch an old wound or something. Maya and I have those. But the arts is like our safe space. That's where we're both most comfortable and most comfortable with each other. And I watched this young actor in all her school plays. I know exactly who she is. I know her strengths. I know her weaknesses. I'm not one of those fathers who is to a fault. I think I'm overly critical of her, you know, because all my best friends are actors. I give myself permission to be critical. You know, Vincent D'Onofrio yell at me if I take too many pauses. And that's just my relationship with other actors, you know, that I've grown to love. You know, try doing three movies with Julie Delpy. You know, I mean, it's like we go at each other about what helps the other one perform and what hurts and what's good and what's valuable. And so I'm not like sitting behind the camera going, my daughter's amazing. I'm asking myself, how can she be better? And the ways to do that is not to dictate anything to her, but to ask her, is she comfortable? Does she have any other ideas? Does she believe that moment? I wasn't sure I did. Did you believe it? Let's try another one. I really love her creative brain is extremely intense. First of all, she's no shrinking violet. She comes onto set with a tremendous amount of energy, passion, and ideas. It's almost like sitting on the front porch as, you know, other people are playing and you're basically saying, hey, don't go into that other field. The dogs are over there. Be careful of the road. But she knows how to play. So my job was just making sure. And also the smartest thing I ever did was get Laura Linney to be in the movie, because then Laura's pursuit of excellence and achievement of it in her life is formidable. I mean, you feel it, it's tactile. She cares a lot about what she's doing. It's not a job to her, it's a life's calling to do this job well, to the best of her ability. And to put a young actor near her is to do them a favor. And I've had those experiences, you know, where you get to be with somebody who's run this track. Laura's run this track. And they both had this very dangerous thing, which is to play multiple characters in a movie, which if done poorly, you start to watch the acting. That was the danger. It's like, it could feel like a stunt if it's working right, it's an organic expression of the characters. It's a living expression. That's the right word for it. And Laura wasn't afraid. And Laura knew how to, okay, this one I'm going to do these weird teeth with. This one I'm going to do this one. This one stands like this. And she kind of applied the same mental acumen that she would if she was playing that character for a whole movie to these four scenes with this character. If you see the movie, you'll know what I mean, that almost like a fan of peacock feathers, each feather is individual, but it accumulates into a whole that's larger than the sum of its parts, right? Not to be corny, but like in a Whitman-esque, I contain multitudes. That's what I wanted for Flannery and Regina. It's like, there's so many women inside these women, you know, and here are some of them.
The movie really could have died with the portrayal of the mother, because that really was...
Oh, that's, that's the movie.
If she doesn't have multitudes and she's just a small-minded woman from the South, which is essentially, if you read the pages, is kind of like how it's played, you know, she would just be the villain. It's hard to imagine.
But Laura doesn't let you off the hook that way, because she is a villain in many aspects, and she also loves her daughter and is keeping her alive. One of my favorite scenes in the movie is the final scene with them just talking about oatmeal. It's so simple. her Herbert Hoover roses.
In the balance of Ethan Hawke, filmmaker, writer, actor, what is the balance like for the next year or so? Is this something where you are writing projects, you're about to go act? Like, how do you keep, in terms of your creativity, is it, well, how do the two mix together?
Acting is the center of the wheel. You know, everything, my relationship to directing and writing and producing or anything else I might do stems out of my love of acting. And I've learned about it from acting. But ultimately, I'm always trying to keep my own curiosity alive and not fatiguing and having burnout. And one of the problems of being a professional actor is if it's all you do, we're all only as good as our opportunities. So it's easy to burn out because you can start working on jobs that you're not passionate about. And you do that for a couple of years and you start to think the profession sucks. And you don't realize it's just you.